I had to pivot. I had to learn to be a different kind of leader and step into a place of discomfort for myself. That meant sharing elements of my lived experience. That meant being vulnerable. That meant being emotional at times with people and not seeing that as weakness, but as a strength leveraged in the right times.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we talk to founders and executives who are transforming and changing their industry about what they uniquely see when it comes to identifying top talent. Please download or subscribe on Apple or Spotify podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and give us a great rating. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. Today, we are joined by Victoria Pelletier, Vice President of Consulting, Digital Transformation, and Global Change Management Leader at Kyndryl. How are you, Victoria?
I'm well. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I'm so excited to have you on. I've been, since we first talked about 6-7 months ago, I've been following along and there's just so much going on and you're such an incredible speaker. So I just want to get into it. There's so many things that I've been thinking about I want to ask you. I want to start here because I love talking about people's career journeys, and you have a very non-traditional professional path. You became the COO for a large global BPO, business process outsourcing, for those not familiar, at the ripe old age of 24. That is very unusual. How did you first get into the workforce, and then how did you rise up that quickly?
Long before child labor laws were in place, I think, because I started working at age 11. I grew up a very like lower middle class family. I was never worried about food or clothing, but there was not money for anything else. So I worked to pay for everything else. I worked in a hair salon. By 14, when I was in my first leadership role, I became the assistant manager of the shoe store I worked at while I was in high school. And then I graduated high school at 16, went off to university with plans on being a lawyer. But while I was doing my undergraduate degree, I worked for a bank. It was very flexible in their contact center to work around school schedule. And I got promoted up through the ranks. And they offered me a relocation across the country for early days of digital banking that I don't think the rest of the world was ready for yet. And so I thought I was taking a year off before going to law school. And I realized, Oz, how much I loved the corporate world, how much I loved being a leader. And so I followed my passion and I kept putting off what I thought was going to be the law school path. And I never did it. And so then I got recruited 6 years into my banking leadership role to that role you mentioned in my intro in terms of being chief operating officer. Huge stretch role for me, but I showed up confidently and I did very much have a number of years of experience in leadership and running call centers.
Okay, so I have a bunch of follow-ups. And listen, this is your show. I like to guess, but I've got to draw some parallels because our journeys are some similar in some ways. Certainly did not graduate at 16 from high school, but what I can tell you is, number one, I've been talking with a lot of different people on this show about favorite questions to ask. And somebody pretty recently, forgetting who, we had a conversation with regards to asking people how old were they when they had their first job and what was it? And I had implemented that in all of my interviews going forward now because there is a high correlation between people that start work at 10, 11, 12 years old, right? Like child labor laws be damned. And get out there and got that grit and got that hustle and have had to work their way up to the top. I personally, my first job, I was 13. I was a ref at the YMCA for 8-year-old basketball, right? And then I went and I was an assistant manager at Ross Dress for Less in the shoe department. I worked at a hat store. I worked at a bagel place. I had all different types of jobs. Then I went to college. Okay. My whole thought was I wanted to go to law school. I also worked at a bank in my undergraduate, not as successful as yours, but I was a personal banker at Wells Fargo and the number one sales guy 2 years in a row for the region of Arizona. So I was very good at selling free checking accounts and overdraft protection. And then I was supposed to go to law school and I graduated. I took my LSATs. I did a great, taking a semester off. I had somebody tell me law school is really expensive. You want to pay for that or do you want to go maybe get some tuition reimbursement at this large corporate organization and start your career? And so then I said, oh, that sounds smart. I'm going to do that. Went interview, got that job, never looked back, never went to law school. So there are some parallels there. But I think the biggest one is like just being somebody that like wanted to get to work right away. And I would say I came from a middle class family. But for me, it was always about like I was the kid that was like selling like blow pops at school or candy bars at school, or I just had this entrepreneurial streak to me for whatever reason. So it's something I look for whenever I'm trying to hire. Okay, enough about me. I want to ask you a follow up on this 24-year-old COO role. I got to ask, like, did they like say, hey, it's a little bit out of the ordinary that we're going to somebody this young, or we're taking a big shot on you? Or did you have any type of understanding of the thought process of putting somebody, obviously very talented, right, with a lot of potential, but like there's risk involved in that for the people involved. So I'm just interested, like, how that conversation went, what came up of it?
I think it was a bunch of reasons why it, coming to their role. So no, they didn't say any of that to me. Legally, from an HR perspective, they couldn't or shouldn't have anyways, but no, they didn't raise it. I think, first of all, I worked for the two guys. It was a private BPO company. They had about 6,000 employees at that point. My role was to lead everything except for finance, quite frankly. So it was a stretch role because I was coming from a very strong operational leadership background. But now things like technology and HR and sales and marketing and all those came to me as well. I ticked a lot of the boxes. The two guys who had built this business, one of them, the CEO himself, was probably only in his mid-30s at that point. So I think having built the business and he himself, so I think he had a much more open mind on age and experience. I ticked the boxes because a lot of their clients were banking clients and I had worked for two. I'm originally from Canada, and so, which your audience will know when I say out and about. Those are the only words. Yeah, those are the only ones that will give you.
You're lying about business process transformation, right? So
no, I say process, actually. So,
my bad.
I told you only out and about are the only ones that give me away as Canadian. And the occasional A, that slips out. But, and so I'd worked for two of Canada's largest banks. They had several banking clients. And then the other reason why I think he gave me this shot is, besides number of years of experience working with and for big banks, which were their clients, was this level of confidence. I've never been a fan. I shouldn't say that. I think I probably did fake it till I make it earlier on, but I'm not a fan. I never coach anyone now to fake it till you make it, except when it comes to confidence. And in that case, it's fake it till you believe it. And I think I realized very early that confidence is equated in the minds of many as competence. And so I knew to show up, even though I don't think we were calling it imposter syndrome back then, but it's a pretty accurate way of describing how I was feeling at 24.
You know, I have this theory that operators are born, not made, right? Like, I mean, were you at a very young age, like breaking things down, or like, I need to go to the grocery store and I need to go to the DMV? And because like, I was a project manager for a while. And then also another parallel, I was CEO for this company until I became CEO in 2019. And I just think that I've always had this mindset of like breaking down a task and like breaking into sub processes and like aligning the. So like, I'm interested, like, is that something that's always been kind of part of who you are, even at that very young age?
Yeah, I think I've had this weird mix of left brain, right brain. The reason I graduated at 16 is because I skipped 2 grades. So I was academically very gifted and I tutored algebra and chemistry. I was very talented on like the sciences, math sciences. So again, following process and logic. But then on the other side, I actually won the drama award for acting. So I have this whole like creative side of me. And what I didn't mention is I bought my first company at age 20. So I bought the casting agency that represented me as an actor. I think that this mix between logic and process and trying to figure things out with this innovation and creativity helped for this like great blend between the two. But I am the type, I joke with people now that I am the type to break stuff just to put it back together again. Do not put me in a status quo environment.
Oh, wow. There is a lot of tales to go down here. Really, I want to stick online because I got a lot I want to get to. So as you progress your career, you've worked for some of the largest and most well-known brands in technology, particularly in the BPO space, Accenture, IBM. What interests me most is that you are a very early adopter of social selling. I think you told me that you are awarded the number one social seller in the entire IBM organization. And I got to be honest, when I think of IBM, Big Blue, I do not think of social selling, but I find that to be remarkably astonishing. Was that something you started doing intentionally? Did you fall into it? And then I'd love to hear any like kind of tips and trades, because this is obviously a very big space now where we're seeing a lot of people really lean into it, present company included.
Yeah, I am. That role, that executive role at 24, I had to learn quickly that the areas that I didn't have familiarity with, so sales, marketing, client management, for example. So coming from a B2C environment to now B2B, the way we had to sell, how do we have to grow? And I just realized a lot of times the team were responding to RFP. And I've always understood how important relationships are and that people do business with and want to work for, buy from people they like and they trust. And so I started to think about how we were winning business. This was I'm almost 49, so 25 years ago now. it was well before the LinkedIn and the social, the digital era that we're in now. And so it was just, how do we build authentic relationships with people? How do we build a strong brand around the company? Yes, but the people, because people are doing business with people. And so that's where it started, even though I didn't have the vernacular to call it personal branding or social selling. So it started there for myself and for my team. And then it's just consistently grown. A big part of my career success is the strength of my brand. I've never, until very recently, I'd never, ever had to look for a job before. I've always been found, directly recruited for my public speaking work. I'm usually referred to someone. So word of mouth. And so I just know how important that is. So I've focused very much on that. And I had a debate with someone when I was at IBM, interestingly, over, I asked a good friend of mine who was the CMO, chief marketing officer for another company, to just do an audit on my own brand. And she told me I needed to have IBM in my subject line, like in my LinkedIn profile. And I said, no. I said, Rosa, I'm more than my title and who I work for. And so that's the way I've always kind of focused. So a brand consists of a multitude of different things and not just what you do and who you do it for. And so it was a result of having then focused for 20 plus years on building a strong brand around who I am as a human holistically, not just, again, what I do, that garnered me the title. It was actually LinkedIn who told me their phrase is social seller. And that's more than just the number of followers or contacts that you have. It's how you engage. Again, it's how you show up. So it's broader than just number of connection requests. And then I subsequently went on, IBM asked me to develop the personal brand training for its executives. And I continue to do that since. And that's actually why I ended up writing one of my books, which was on personal branding.
You would have thought IBM and Victoria invented influencer marketing. Maybe that's going a little bit too far, but that's really amazing. I love that story. You were really out front of it. I find that people don't, back when I was growing up, it was more about the logo. I bought Coca-Cola, or I go shop at Home Depot, or I buy Nike, right? But I do agree with you, particularly for businesses like the size of mine, like you have to know the person that you're dealing with. When you're selling to somebody, even in one of these large organizations, you're not buying from IBM as much as you're buying from Victoria, right? And building that brand is super, super important. It's something I've seen the power of. It's not something I was always comfortable with, but I absolutely understand now why it's important and why it leads to great things for yourself and for your business if you do it properly and effectively. Interesting about LinkedIn, two technologies that I was a really early adopter on were LinkedIn and Twitter, right now known as X. And I got involved with LinkedIn back in like 2000, I want to say 6 or 7. I just moved into recruiting and I was like, oh, well, this seems like a great place for me to be able to find potential candidates. And so much so that they came to me and they actually flew me to 2 or 3 different locations to go evangelize why LinkedIn was worth joining and why it was a great place to be on. And so it's obviously become a big part of my company and what we do now. Very grateful for LinkedIn and all it's done, and then Twitter as well. But that's just really interesting because they were growing social media and it seems like they were recognizing who was doing it well or who wasn't and latching onto that. So it's really cool that they caught on to you. Before we get into the book, because I didn't want to talk about that, why Kyndryl? Why, if you only took the role a couple months ago, I'm just interested, what drew you to the organization? Was it something about the vision? Was it the scope of the role? What are you excited about?
Well, I got recruited from IBM to go to Accenture. I turned Accenture down at the same time as IBM recruited me. And when I left Accenture, I thought I was getting out of consulting. I was actually really looking to go into a private equity portfolio company, leveraging my years as an executive, all the merger and acquisition experience I had, turnaround experience in that environment. It was not the right time. There was not a lot of deal flow. And then I saw a former leader of mine, who was the most senior executive when I was being recruited into IBM, join Kyndryl. And I was like, oh, wow, like, I'm surprised. Like, why did you come here? Because he had left IBM as well. And going back to people do business with people they like and they trust. He's a big part of the reason why I decided to join. Not the only. I would want to make sure it was for more reasons than that. But working for a leader that I trust, I like, and he's a rock star leader. He's a bit of a disturber and making stuff happen, which is great. But
Did you not use the word disruptor? Do you think that's getting cliche or...
Well, I was going to swear I had a different word and I thought,
yeah, that's okay. This is not a family podcast. You can swear.
So he stirs up a lot of shit. Shit disturber is technically actually
what instigator type situation, kind of makes a stir in the pot. I got it.
What? And I like that. I'm a lot like that. So like he and I get along and he's brought along and built a team we're all very similar in that way. And so Kyndryl spun out of IBM 3 years ago. So as much as I was new entering into it 6 months ago or 5 months, whatever it was, there's still a lot of familiarity with it, but we're also growing significantly. What spun out 3 years ago from IBM, they weren't allowed to do some of the things we can now do that were 3 years post. So it, to some extent, it feels like a startup within a 90,000 person organization. And so the fact that we get to transform the way we're operating on the inside, what, how we bring value to our clients, and also delivering really cool shit for clients, like with great people, great solutions, that excites me. And he's asked me to do really neat things like help lead our own executive leadership development, which is great.
I'm thrilled for you. That is exciting. That sounds amazing. I want to talk a little bit about the books you've written. So the one I think you wrote most recently is called Are Traditional Leadership Models Failing You? I'd like to understand, why did you write this book? And can you give us kind of a, just a brief overview of what it's about?
Yeah, that's actually a clip from the book. It's actually called The Power of Whole Human Leadership.
Oh, I'm firing my research team. I can't believe that. I'm sorry. Say it again, because I want people to buy it if they want it. What is it called?
The Power of Whole Human Leadership.
Okay.
And I wrote that book because I've left companies because of poor culture and leaders. We know that people don't quit companies. They quit their leaders generally. And I wanted to demonstrate how I've achieved what I have a strong followership of people who will come and work with me and follow me and speak highly of me. But that's only after I made really serious mistakes as a young leader. So stepping into that role at 24 years old, I wore a mask in that of what I believed was strength. And then I would never show vulnerability. I rarely showed emotional, and I'm a super emotional individual, like a marshmallow. I cry at the Humane Society commercials on TV, but I didn't show any of that. So my nickname in my mid to late 20s was the Iron Maiden. I've always been very confident in managing performance, talking about like process and breaking things down. And I've always been okay to have the tough conversations, even though it was super painful for me, but I never showed that. So Iron Maiden was my nickname. And I was like, it crushed me because that's not actually who I am. And so I had to pivot. I had to learn to be a different kind of leader and step into a place of discomfort for myself. That meant sharing elements of my lived experience. That meant being vulnerable. That meant being emotional at times with people and not seeing that as weakness, but as a strength leveraged in the right times. And so that's why I wrote the book. I stepped into the workforce when it was very much a command and control environment. And coming out of, I don't like the headlines they grabbed, but so the Great Resignation or Quiet Quitting. Don't love the phrases of those, but the reality is it stands for something. And there's this crescendo that happened sort of during COVID era and beyond where people were demanding something very different from the companies they worked for, the companies they bought from, and then certainly the leaders that they worked for. And so I wanted to help with some of the life lessons I've had to get to. Now my nickname is the Turtle. I've got the tattoo here to prove. And that's much more, I'm this strong, resilient leader, but still very soft on the inside.
Yeah, listen, so I love that you broke that down. I appreciate that vulnerability. A couple of things, like even when you're reading books by John Maxwell and other leaders, like leadership is an evolving thing, right? Like I've many times talked about leadership on my LinkedIn and things like that. And I would tell you, I've gone for a bit of a transformation and self-reflection over the last 6 months myself as I go forward and what I need to be for my business. And so I think it's always an iterative thing. Even who you are as a leader right now will change and iterate as you learn more, as you continue to grow throughout your career. I think you would agree that, I mean, I think you probably thought that as a default, you had to put up that kind of strong back, and especially as a female, especially as somebody young in the organization, there's tinges of misogyny and things like that come into that, more than tinges maybe, depending on where you work. And so part of it is like, you don't have the benefit of being able to be vulnerable, to be open, because it's seen as maybe a sign of weakness. Whereas if you were, you know, an established 40-year-old man, maybe who has a bunch of pelts on the wall, you can maybe get away with that more. I mean, vulnerability is at times, it shouldn't have to be, but it can be a luxury, right? You have to feel like, because if you're vulnerable, you don't have credibility, then you're going to shoot yourself in the foot, because then people are, then you might have people questioning your leadership. So I certainly understand why that happened. I look at that as the appropriate evolution of somebody that's growing in their career. You probably didn't have to do it to be the Iron Maiden back then as much as you think you did, right? We always tend to overcorrect on that, but I really get the frame of mind that would have brought you to that. So I find that to be super, super interesting. I want to ask you something, because we are in a unique time. And I was the Great Resignation was happening and quiet quitting. And I talked a lot about the pendulum, right? And it really tends to go like this. And it really had swung towards employees for a good few years there, whether that be expectations, right, of what a company is supposed to do for a company, whether it be programs and what companies are supposed to say, when and what, in addition to just a comp and things like that. So I'm interested from your perspective. I believe in all of those tenets, but it feels like there's been a little bit of a shift over the last, I don't know, 6 to 8 months. And I'm not going to tie any kind of event to that. I'm just saying that it feels like there's a little bit of a shift. What do you see, right, from your perspective? And does that change anything in terms of the things you've been talking about over the last 3 or 4 years, where this was way more in your face or a bigger part of like the zeitgeist, whereas now it feels like it's kind of be pushed a little bit secondarily? And I don't think that's a great thing, but I'm just interested in your take on all that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I often talk about a pendulum as well. So another similarity there. And I do feel like it swung so far, but perhaps because no one was listening, I think. So I think it needs to go there so that it can start to come back and normalize wherever that's going to be. Yes, I feel it's swinging a little bit too far back the other way right now. And so it has started to change the dialogue, whether it's my former employer Accenture, who just announced in the last several days that they're eliminating their DEI targets and objectives, in large part because Accenture Federal Services, they're government focused, US government focused. So they're just responding to, despite it, that fact that was such a strong value for them. So just the conversation that's happening out of things like that. But also, I spend a lot of time with business leaders and CHROs thinking about how do you optimize your workforce, in large part because not only where they work, but how they work is changing through technology, through AI, all of those things. So I'm having this conversation and they're asking the question. And so the conversation's shifted from, yes, heavy DEI focused, a lot more on leadership values, back to meritocracy. I'm saddened by that because the numbers are still the numbers that show that the diversity statistics are poor. Yet there's data that proves when we have a more diverse workforce, there's greater innovation and problem solving. At the board level, there's less risk associated by seeing that with a diverse board. So it disappoints me. And I think we need to be creative at looking at the workforce differently. That's myopic view changes for some.
How can we thread the needle? How can we have meritocracy be something at the forefront of our business and what we're trying to do, but also be inclusive, also champion the objective business reality that diversity of thought, reflection of our customers is a good thing, right? And what I think what's interesting about this whole conversation, the dichotomy is, if everything exists on spectrum, okay? And I think things were very favored here for certain groups, okay? And for employers and wealth and like just different things. Like it just is what it is. Like we have to objectively understand that like there is like, there's a reason people are trying to either move in those directions or see that people are getting certain things for being in the direction. And so by definition, if you want to bring things closer to the middle, which is probably the right place of where you want to be, right? You have to index all the way out here to bring things closer to the middle. But unfortunately, what it feels like is that some of that, right or wrong, has led to some level of like backlash of like, no, it's going too far. It's doing too much of these things. And yet that is by design what has to happen to bring things to some level of centeredness and normalness. So it's not an easy topic. There's lots of different opinions and views. Who knows where things are going and where they'll be. But I just hope there's a conversation to be had. Because listen, I am a American. I believe in capitalism. I believe in meritocracy. I believe that we should have all those things. It does drive innovation. It does. But I also think that being the richest country in the world, there is an obligation to take care of all of your people. To give, I always like to say, I believe in equality of opportunity, not necessarily equality of outcome, right? And I think it's a very fair conversation to say that not everybody started from the same place. We talked about lower middle class, right? I grew up middle class, right? We've had success. Like we had to fight through it. But the reality is that there was a lot of things in our way and other people's ways that stopped that from happening. That'd be better if we somehow lifted those so that we could truly have meritocracy, right? Where everybody's starting at the same starting point. Anyway, I'm going on a little bit of a diatribe, but it's just like, you know, it's just funny with the pendulum going back and forth, and we could talk about where things are or where they're going. But to me, I do think that these things can live in balance, right? The problem is that they've been so focused so far for so long one way that you understand why people were trying to very hard to pull it another way and get it to be somewhere that makes more sense for everybody. Do you disagree with anything I'm saying or?
No, I completely agree. And it's interesting. I think of actually having to say to my younger son at one point, who was complaining that he didn't have the same right being 4 years younger than his older brother. I'm like, look, it's fair, but not equal. And so I think about that in the workplace as well. And so I agree with you. We can drive towards a more diverse, inclusive culture and have high performance and have high return. It's not a trade-off. It means we need to lead and do things a little differently. We can have both.
Love that. Spot on. So this is not going to surprise anybody, but in addition to being an accomplished writer, you are also an accomplished professional speaker. You recently did a TEDx, I think, at a conference worldwide. I want you to bring us behind the curtain, because when we see the TEDx, I know they have a very big framework. It's very polished. It almost always comes across as like, wow, that's one of the best speeches I've ever seen. I'm interested to know from your perspective, what is your process in preparing for a presentation? And then I'm just interested, there's a lot of executives, including myself, who get asked to do speaking engagements. If somebody's nervous, and maybe I'm asking for myself, maybe I'm not, but what are some tips that you might add to kind of calm those nerves, get centered, and focus on the task at hand?
Well, don't start with a TEDx or a TED Talk, I'll tell you that. Start small. I've been speaking. I said I was an actor, so I was always comfortable on stages. Although the interesting thing, Oz, is when I had to start speaking for business, there's no longer this caricature that I'm playing. Now it's just Victoria speaking on stage. That actually made me nervous a little bit at first, even though I'd been on in front of thousands of people as an actor before. For me, what I would say to people is start on smaller stages. And sometimes that's just in a boardroom. Start to small audience of 5 or 10 and get comfortable with the message that you're going to share there before you move to these much larger formats and stages. Also, be really comfortable with your content. I don't like to speak on things. Like, I was asked many years ago to be, I know I was supposed to be the MC or something for an AI conference. Early days. And I'm like, I am not an expert. Now, MC is slightly different than actually giving a talk on it, but I didn't even have a comfort level to do that. So for me, I want to be able to stand on stage and talk about something I have knowledge and experience in part because I don't ever want to have to refer to notes. And so for me, most of my slides, although I'll have a slide up, it's usually a picture and not a ton of words unless I'm presenting some data in a very much more of a business context. And so I'm not worried that I'm going to mess up. That's where I would say, know your content well, baby steps in smaller stages before you arrive to the big ones. And then to the question over TED, they do have a rigorous process. I'm fortunate. I had sort of stated, I put it out there that I wanted them to approach me. I didn't want to have to apply, which is what happened. And so many people though, so for those who might be interested that are listening, I mean, you can, TED doesn't make it not hard, but it's a long process. You go and you find where there's local TEDs and you find out who are the organizers and you connect with those organizers. They don't make the connecting part with them easy because you'll have to find them on LinkedIn or wherever else to connect with them, find out how you can apply. And many times you'll have to apply over and over again because there's a ton of applicants. So that's the part I was fortunate to skip. But I will say if you're an inexperienced or speaker, they've got a great process. They'll assign someone who works with you on the content itself who will help rehearse with you. I didn't need any of that. But I will tell you, this was one of the talks I was the most stressed over, nervous about, mostly because it did actually require me being almost completely memorized. I'm used to giving keynote talks of 45 to 60 minutes, and this is 14. So to distill all of that down to somewhere between 11 to 14 minutes meant I had to be memorized, but you want to sound like it's natural. So there was a lot of practice, but it was great. And then the producer asked me to open the show. I'm like, way to go, like add more pressure. She's like, no, I know you can do it. I want you to set the tone for the night. So it was a phenomenal experience. I really enjoyed it. Became friends with a number of the other speakers, and I look forward to doing more.
That's awesome. And if we want to look it up, what will it be under?
So it's on the TEDx YouTube. Sadly, so.
What's the topic, though?
It's on resilience. It's called Healthy Resilience. So if TEDx Miami, my name, or resilience, that'll bring it up. I have over 1.5 million views, even though it just came out once they edited everything. It came out at the end of August, which is amazing. I'm really proud of that. But someone joked with me over whether I got any of the money from all the ads or royalties. I'm like, no, that all goes to TED. That all goes to TED.
Should have signed a royalty contract. No, I get it. Oh, wow. That's awesome. 1.5 million views. That's super impressive. I am going to definitely check that out. And I would recommend our listeners do as well. I want to talk a little bit about hiring, because you can't be a 24-year-old COO without having hired some people throughout your career and obviously growing through that. I want to start with this. When it comes to bringing people into your organization or your team, do you have a core hiring philosophy?
I do. It flexes, I will tell you, depending on the situation. So I've always been a leader who's going back to, I don't want to make this all about DEI, but I always try and create an environment that has diversity. The role in BPO, that's not a destination job. It's often people unemployed or underemployed or new to the country. So they're not there for a long time. So if I can get them to stay longer, be more engaged, so there is naturally diverse. I'm just going to say that's where it comes from. So I will try to build a team that's more diverse. But by that, I'm not talking about the color of skin or religion. I'm also just talking about diversity of experience, work, lived experience, all of those, because that brings richness to the conversation, to our ability to create, innovate together as a team. So that's for sure a principle that I have. I've also been comfortable with hiring people that have some, but not all of the skill, but they have the right fit, that dynamic within the team, or they have an incredible propensity to learn. And more so now, because the shelf life of skills is reduced so drastically, we need people who are very agile with much more of that growth mindset, who are adept and comfortable and navigating to new and different. So that's something I'm looking at. That said, I think of Kyndryl where we are right now, there's lots of transformation and we're in a massive growth mode. I have several roles that I'm hiring for where I'm not willing to be flexible on people with very direct experience doing basically this role for one of our competitors, in part because I know I don't have the time to give them to coach them, but also we're in an environment where that's what's required. So that's where I will flex my sort of principles or what I will look for to ensure they're successful with the level of coaching or support I can give them, but also the dynamic around.
Super nuanced answer. I love that you didn't have a silver bullet there. You're right. It can be very situational depending. Great answer. What about a memorable interview experience? If anything, go ask him that, because maybe you were interviewing, maybe you're interviewing somebody, good, bad, doesn't matter. You don't have to name names, but just interested if anything comes to mind.
Oh, I have so many stories. I'm like just trying to...
I can see your mental Rolodex is going right now.
I know. Well, because I do a lot, because I've written several books and because I do a number of talks like this with you, and I'm quite honestly an open book. I've had some that come to me and they've done so much research, which I would hope someone would do when interviewing, but please don't tell me all of my intimate details to my face. Like then it gets a bit creepy. But here's an example of where someone did that, didn't do their homework when I was interviewing with them. And it was the CEO of a large family office, and to be the CEO of one of his portfolio companies. And he's like, wait, tell me your story. And I'd said a few things. Like one, I said that my ex had passed away, and it was a reason for an impetus for one of my career changes, because I needed to then, as a single parent, not be on the road all the time. And he made an assumption on that, and I'll come to it in a sec. And then secondarily, I was talking about my children, and he asked and what they were. And I made reference and I slipped and used different pronouns. My youngest is a trans male son, so born female. And so I refer to him when he was younger, those memories are wired as she, her. And so I explained that and my ex was an ex-wife. I'm now married to a man. I've been openly queer all my life. And this level of like sort of shock. And I remember saying to him, like, first of all, my CV itself talks about all my work for around diversity and often for the LGBTQ community as the executive sponsor for the business resource groups, et cetera, the awards I've won. And I just said, like, did you Google me? And so he appeared to know nothing about me.
How did this shock manifest itself? Like, what does he do? Is like his mouth agape? Is he like, I can't believe this? Like, I'm just interested. Like, how do you respond in an interview with shock when somebody's telling you personal details?
It actually, I knew pretty early on he came from a very strong, committed religious faith and background. So he'd already made the comment around my ex-husband passing. And I just initially I let it go. And then when it came up about my son, and I said, you know what? I'm going to take a step back here. Because at this point, he's now asking me to join as CEO for one of his companies. And I said, you know, I want to wind back to earlier in our conversation. I said, you know, when you said that about my ex-husband, I said, I just want to let you know it's an ex-wife. It was like literally like that. Oh, and he was just stumbling around. And as he then tried to catch back up in the conversation and pretend that it really didn't bother him. But it was interesting. Forget from like that for a moment. The reality is you're hiring me as a CEO for one of your companies. He offered me my choice of two companies, one of which was his baby. He built it, and it was the foundation to afford all the wealth he has now and buy all these other companies. To not have thoroughly read my CV or to done a little bit of homework on me.
So that level of position, it's saying we're always advising candidates to do your research, know who you're walking into. Obviously, you did that, and have great questions prepared and know what you want. And yes, if you're going to be hiring at any level of position, let alone a CEO of some of your most important companies, then yeah, I would think some cursory research up front, especially as you're getting ready to like lock the person in and make them an offer. That seems almost kind of insane, but it feels like that was the right fit. So it seems like he told on himself.
So that was a balance of when I talk about the interview experience, do your homework. I agree. That's great advice that you're giving to people, but please don't tell me all of it in the interview. Like then it gets
No. In a minute. in your TED talk in minute 13 when you said XYZ. Like, I just thought that was amazing. And then you moved here and did that. Like, yeah, that's probably a bit much. You know? It's a self-awareness is a very key trait when you're hiring. That's for sure. Yeah. Do you have a favorite question that you like to ask in interviews?
Not really. I hate sometimes where I've worked at companies where they've got like something scripted they want us to fill out. And that just doesn't work for me. First of all, I assume by the time they've gotten to me, most of the technical stuff, competencies and capabilities of the role are there. So I'm usually then assessing a lot more for fit and some of those other aspects. So for me, I do try and go with the flow and where the conversation's gone. But what I will often try and test for is when I talked about agile and problem solving.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because the learning agility, how do you determine that interview?
So ask them to talk me through scenarios. I may or may not give them a scenario, or I can say, here's kind of, you know, an environment we're in right now, or a challenge we face, like, how would you handle that? Or talk to me about a situation where, you know, this didn't go well. What did you do? How did you, and I've worked in lots of mostly multinational organizations, highly matrixed. So I like to test for that. Like, how do you navigate around that kind of environment? The way I ask it will be different, but I'm going to ask something along those lines in every single one of the conversations and interviews that I have.
Love that. You know, we all miss, right, on people sometimes. So like when you have, do you notice a theme of maybe something that you've matured out of or grown or learned from early on in your career? Or maybe sometimes you still make the same mistake. Like, are there any themes that you look at when you miss on somebody? Why?
There's only been a few misses. There was one actually recently someone whom I knew from a networking group who presented extremely well. And I think I probably trusted and thought there was going to be a much greater fit. What I didn't test for was there was a missing EQ, and there was an extreme amount of a lack of confidence that just manifested in it. And I think because of the context in which we met, I didn't do enough testing in the interview as I would have otherwise. So that was a miss for me. And then there was one early in my career where I was hiring a manager into a role where he was going to have to manage like people. I knew he was stepping into a team that was not performing. And I asked him to take me through, and he'd given me an example that maybe wasn't perfect, but there was a lot of other pieces that I thought were going to be a fit. And I ended up letting him go in his probationary period because he wanted to come in and be friends with everyone. And I just, so 6 weeks in, I'm like, oh, we need to. And so I gave him the coaching right away. So it wasn't a shock or a surprise. But ultimately, I own it. I hired him. It was a miss. And so I learned it. And again, a lot more of the questions in that scenario based to ask, but I'm going to put someone in that kind of situation.
Yeah. An interesting exercise I heard from somebody is put a calendar event day 30 when you hire somebody on your team and ask yourself, knowing what I know now, would I still rehire this person? And if the answer is even a hesitation or not, it's in both your best interest and their best interest to let them go, right? Because during that 30 days, like, if it's not like a honeymoon or it's not like, then there was something usually missed, and you're doing somebody a favor by identifying that early. At the same time, and I'm glad you take accountability for it, you know, if somebody's gone in the first 6 weeks, 8 weeks, right? Good on you for recognizing it and moving on it. But also, it's a great call out by yourself. That's not on them, right? That's on something in the hiring process or doing the due diligence process that you've got to figure out. And you can make case over time that maybe it's the management, maybe it's the long-term, maybe there were changes in the organization that kind of changed things for them. But that early on, you know, I tell my manager all the time, if you come to me 6 weeks or 8 weeks in and say, I'm not sure about this person, I'm going to say, we either got a hiring problem or a management problem. We got to figure it out right away because we can't. There is a real bottom line impact to making the wrong hire. And we're doing a disservice to the people we hire in addition to our company. So I think that's a great call up by you. We're going to get to our speed round in a minute. I got a couple ideas on that, but I want to ask you a couple questions first. You have written more than a couple books, but I'm interested, what's something you've read recently that you'd recommend to our listeners, or maybe any other form of content? Could be movie, could be TV.
I'm up for like voracious consumer of content. So I'm just trying to think of what it is. And I love the physicality of a book. I love the smell, but that no longer fits for my life. I know I see them and I stare up because mine's right beside me, but I've had to cull down. I used to have a massive library, but as I've gone smaller and smaller over time, it's much smaller, the library itself. And
yeah, so I'll tell you another thing I love about a physical book. One, I read a lot on planes, so that like I love having the book there for that, right? But the other thing is I love to give. I think the greatest gift you can give somebody is a great book. I love this book, and this is perfect for you, so I'm giving it to you. So I have a lot of books, but also I've given a lot away. But go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
So I consume a lot audibly now. So also when I'm traveling, but also at the gym, and lots of podcasts. So there's a ton of podcasts that I listen to like that. It's funny. I used to be a pure music girl at the gym, and I don't know how I get pumped, but I'm listening to like news and a related like business podcast. I'm just trying to think of what I'm looking up to see, because I've got to.
It can be your podcast too. It can be any type of content. Whatever's really like inspiring you right now, you love.
We don't want to make this political, but I will tell you, I've spent a lot of time listening to This Is Us, The Rest Is Us. It's both originally out of the UK, and now they have it in the US. And it's Scaramucci and Katie, who are the two, just back and forth. And just, even though I'm a Canadian and I can't even vote in the US as a permanent citizen, as a permanent resident here, I'm like just so immersed in like American politics. And so listening all the time to that. And then there's another one called My First Million. And so they just bring on interesting speakers who talk about, again, business. And many times I like absolutely disagree with some of that they bring on, but that itself like gets me interested in listening to it. And I also like, but they're way, way too long, Andrew Huberman's podcast.
I really am fascinated by like taking care of yourself and getting your mind, your spirit, your body right. And he just breaks it down at such a molecular level. That's really interesting. But yeah, you're right. That is a commitment to get through one of those.
And the last I will leave your audience, there was one, I think it's done over two podcasts given the length, but it was Brown with Simon Sinek and Adam Grant. Three of them together.
Right there, all together, huh? Wow. Yeah, I love Simon Sinek, great author. Adam Grant also written some good books, and Brené Brown is kind of one of the founding mothers, or like one of the godfathers or godmothers of everything when it comes to employee relations and how to take care of people and EQ and psychology. So love that. That is a good one. I will check that out. Last question, and then we're going to speed round. If you had any advice that you'd give 20-year-old Victoria that you didn't know then, but that you know now, what would it be?
Probably a little bit connected to that vulnerability, that it's okay to be me, to let the real me and stories shine through. I didn't need to shy away or fear from sharing.
I love that. All right, I got a couple questions before we get into speed round. What province in Canada are you from?
Several. Born in Ontario, but I grew up in Calgary, and then I got relocated while I was working for that bank back to Toronto. And so Toronto's probably the most home Canadian city for me.
Okay. That's going to come back up in a second. And then you mentioned a couple different times about being an actress, and I want to pick at this a little bit. Sounds like it was on stage because you said in front of thousands of people. Fair?
Yeah, mostly on stage. I did some small like television and commercial stuff, but mostly stage.
Here we go. First question. What is the biggest stage production that you played a relatively big part of?
It actually only held 1,000 people, stage production. I was the lead actor in that. It was 1,000.
Stage production is the name of the play?
Oh, no. Stage? Oh, no. The name of the play.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. It was. I remember the woman who produced it, and her production house was called Chimera. And it was, I even still have a picture of it, but I can't even remember the name of it.
What's the dream role you'd want to play on stage?
Oh, I prefer dramatic. And okay. So it'd have to be something very dramatic. Although I've done Shakespeare, it's not what I prefer. So I don't know. But something like provocative. I can't tell you like one for sure, but something like, I just love dropping
something like meaty drama. Something you can show your chops. Okay. Greatest Canadian export.
That's hard because there's so many good ones. Like I played hockey, so I could say like Gretzky or good Canadian girl. I played hockey. My kids played competitive hockey. And so there's a ton of like great Canadian hockey players that have come out of there. Some phenomenal singers. Celine Dion.
Celine Dion, right? There's some there.
Right, there's a lot. And on the acting side, like Jim Carrey's Canadian.
I think Ryan Reynolds is definitely Canadian. Jim Carrey, right? Yeah. So there's a lot there. Okay. So we've got a lot of good famous celebrity exports. What about food? What's the greatest Canadian meal?
Oh, if my husband is listening in, he'd be telling me to tell you a poutine. So
You're a poutine fan? Yeah, of course.
My husband's originally from Quebec City, which they debate that Quebec City versus Montreal, who created the poutine? My husband will say it was in Quebec, but it is. There's those cheese curds. You can't get them. Wisconsin, I know, it's going to try and beat for that, but that's probably one of the best.
My buddy's from Wisconsin. I've had cheese curds like all up and down Wisconsin, but you're saying that Canada is really the place to go.
There's a few places, yes, that are pretty amazing. I've tried down here in the U.S. to like get a good poutine. It's very difficult.
What's the best thing about Toronto in your mind for somebody who hasn't visited?
It's a smaller, cleaner version of New York.
I could not agree more. I love that city.
And for me, it is diversity. So growing up in Western Canada, where there was not a lot of diversity, I remember when I landed there, and my mom was such an incredible woman who was always so much focused on diversity and just loving everyone. And so when I moved to Toronto, I was like, it's here. where I struggled to find it in Calgary. And the and with that comes, you think of the food. I don't know if they still hold a stat, but at one point they had, I think, the highest restaurants per capita. And so with all the different neighborhoods and pockets you can go to, you can get a little bit of a taste of anything you want, which I think is amazing. But as a business person, like, it's the business hub for Canada as well. So there's just such greatness for me in Toronto.
I love that. Do you have a favorite restaurant in Toronto you'll recommend for our listeners?
Okay, this is going to sound horrible because it's a chain, but it's The Keg, which is a, like a steak chain. But I think it's because I had a routine and was going there. And there's just a few things you could only get there that I can't find anywhere else. Even though it's not the most special of, like, there's some great Indian and some other things I've done. But if when I go back because I can't get it here, that's typically where I go.
Hey, listen, I love it. I'm a big Tim Hortons fan too. Used to be a customer of ours. Love to get some Timbits. I love the chains up in Canada. All right, last one. So are you a Leafs fan, Oilers fan, or Flames fan based on where you said you've been?
That's hard. Well, first of all, Oilers, 100% no. Growing up in Calgary, there was a rivalry between Edmonton and Calgary, so I'll never.
Yeah, you mentioned Gretzky earlier, so I don't know if, like, you grew up loving Gretzky. So no, Flames, you're out on the Oilers.
Like Gretzky, yes, but I struggle. It depends. So if they're both playing against one another, I'm probably actually rooting for the Flames, but otherwise I tend to go for Toronto.
Calgary has, like, a big, like, horse or equestrian rodeo type situation out there.
What?
Like, what? Yeah. So tell us about that. What is that?
Yes, it's known as the greatest outdoor show on earth, the Calgary Stampede. So it runs for 2 weeks in July, and it's great. It's just like, they do actually have rodeos and lots of animals, but it's where they bring out a fair. You can go on the rides, try all the, like, fried food that you could possibly imagine. They've got big stars who come out and perform. So it's pretty cool during that time. And by the way, one of the best times to be there. You don't want to be in Calgary in the winter.
No, it doesn't sound like it. Now, Banff is relatively close to Calgary, or am I right there? But my Canadian geography is not what it should be.
You're doing really well. It's just north, and it's beautiful. I mean, the Rocky Mountains. And so you do actually want to explore. I've never been much of a skier, but if you are, it's great. But it's just stunning to go and see and have the opportunity to walk or hike through the mountains there.
I love it. Victoria, we talk more Canada than you probably expected, but I love to, like, learn where people are from and what they're about and what they get to know you personally. Got to know a little bit about you professionally. Congrats on the new role at Kyndryl. Very excited for you. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Victoria, I'll see you later.